Combattimento Concert of Amsterdam, led by Jan Willem de Vriend, played a concerto by one of their countrymen, Peter Hellendahl.
This is WHFR Dearborn at Henry Ford Community College, and thank you for tuning in to this beautiful classical programming. If you would like to learn more about other happenings, other musical styles, and other events here at WHFR Radio, then we invite you to become a WHFR loyal listener. It's as simple as this. Please give me a call, Susan McGraw, WHFR General Manager, at 313-845-9842. That number again is 313-845-9842. Simply leave your name, your complete address, and your telephone number, and I will put you on the free WHFR Loyal Listener mailing list. You'll receive a bi-monthly program guide with information about show times and dates and places that we're going to be around town and so much more. Become a WHFR Loyal Listener for free. Give me a call today, and thanks for tuning in.
You're listening to WHFR Dearborn. We're bringing you non-commercial radio from Henry Ford Community College.
The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford Community College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. Where local investigators as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. Hi, I'm David Twitchell, and you are listening to WHFR Dearborn. And for the next hour, we will be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomenon. As skeptics will argue, if UFOs visit this planet with such frequency, surely we have some kind of physical evidence. Well, in fact, we do. When UFOs land on terra firma, they usually leave big footprints that may be scientifically analyzed in the field and in the laboratory. Ted Phillips of Reed Springs, Missouri, has been reading these footprints for many years. He is the author of the celebrated Physical Traces Associated with UFO Sightings, a preliminary catalog that was published in 1975 by CUFOS, the Center for UFO Studies. And he has investigated more than 4,000 physical trace landing cases in his storied career and has been interviewed on countless documentaries on the subject. And we are honored to have him on the show today. And welcome to the show, Mr. Phillips.
Thank you, Dave.
And how are things in Missouri?
Well, they're drying out. We have had several weeks of flooding here.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it'll be a dehydrated spring. Mm-hmm. But things are finally drying out, the water's receding, and luckily I live on a very high hill, so I didn't have a lot of that problem.
Oh, very good. Well, you have been studying trace landing evidence of UFO sightings, and I believe your career began in 1964 in Socorro, New Mexico. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
Tell us about that.
Well, it turned out to be the turning point for me, and also for a good friend, J. Allen Hynek. And we were both there immediately after the landing, and we didn't know each other then. We would meet 4 years later and begin a joint investigation that lasted until he passed away in 1986. But Socorro, of all the trace cases, the landing trace cases, Socorro is in the top 10, perhaps even the top 5. And because of the number of witnesses, the primary witnesses' credibility, the strangeness of the physical evidence that was generated by the object, and just the overall quality of the case, it's a good one.
Well, what exactly happened in this case?
Well, very briefly, Lonnie Zamora, police officer in Socorro, New Mexico, was in pursuit in daylight of a speeding motorist, and a family was driving north on the north-south highway into Socorro, and the gentleman, his wife, and their kids noticed an object flying very low to the ground in a descending path. It passed over their automobile. It was so close, they thought it was going to hit the antenna on the car. And they watched as it passed over the highway and then on to the west over the desert area. And it seemed to descend below some hills to the west of them. And coming towards them was Lonnie Zamora. And he called the dispatcher and told them he had just observed an object descending into the area of a dynamite shack and was breaking off his pursuit of the motorist and going to investigate because he was afraid that the dynamite shack might explode. And he made his way several hundred feet off the highway and back up over the hill. And as he crested a ridge, he could see down below him about 185 feet away an object that looked like a an elongated metallic device. It was about 18, 20 feet in length, and it was resting on the ground on four structured landing legs. And beneath it, as he was getting out of the car and actually moved to a little closer area, about 165 feet, he could see what appeared to be two small people in white coveralls underneath the object. And he, in trying to get closer, bumped against the door of the car, and at that point suddenly there was a terrific roar and a burst of flame from the underneath section of the object, and it jumped about 30 feet into the air. The flame went out, the sound stopped, and the object was just stationary about 30 feet above the desert floor. And after a very brief period of hovering, it started moving away with no sound and gaining altitude, and it was just moving away relatively slow as UFOs go. And he called in the report again, and a New Mexico Highway Patrolman was on his way out, and he joined Lonnie at the top of the ridge, and the two of them went down to where this thing had been. And they found large bushes still smoldering from actually not a fire, but extreme heating. And around this area, they found four indentations in the sand, rectangular footpads from the four legs. And the things were about 8 by 12 inches in size. And so the investigation began from that point.
And you were on the scene, you say, immediately. How soon after How soon after the event did you, were you there?
About a day and a half. Mm-hmm. I say immediate. That was immediate for those days.
Yeah, right. And you were coming from Missouri?
Yes.
Okay. And when did J. Allen Hynek come on the scene? Now, he was with the... this was 64, though. Was he with
Project
Blue Book?
Blue Book.
At
yes.
the time?
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
yeah.
He was the hardened skeptic.
Oh, yes.
That the government hired because he was such a skeptic. And their job, of course, was to poo-poo all of the UFO sightings.
Well, it certainly was, yes.
So what did he think? Obviously, you and he compared notes later.
Yes.
What did he think of this sighting?
Well, he was dramatically impressed because he was immediately impressed with Lonnie Zamora, as he didn't make any, he was not embellishing the situation at all. He was, I have a couple of his original sketches of the object, and to say they were crude would simplify it. And he didn't make a big thing of seeing these two small people. That was, he actually didn't much like to talk about it. It was sort of pried out of him. And the physical evidence was such that Bill Powers at Northwestern, a good friend of Allen's, did a study of the distribution of the foot pads by angle and distance between them and arrangement. And as a professor of engineering, he was well equipped to do that. And he came to the conclusion that not only this was some sort of constructed device, but that the imprints were arranged in such a way to keep the object level with the terrain that it landed on, and by some sort of sensing system.
Right.
And so it just has held up, and it's still carried in Blue Book files as an unknown.
Well, what about the land itself, the ground, the ring? Did you say it left a ring?
No. In that case,
just the pads.
It didn't. And those types of objects in the trace landings don't leave rings. They sometimes you'll find the scorched areas, irregular scorched areas. You'll find the four landing pad marks, which vary in size according to the size of the object in that type, and the distribution will be either smaller or considerably larger. And the interesting thing is I have a number of cases with that type of object from all over the planet that show the same type of rectangular imprints, and the distribution is relatively close in size and distance.
So, in other words, you say that some kind of sensors were in these landing pads to adjust to the terrain. So, if the terrain were sloped, for example, there'd be more pressure on one side than there would on the other, or it would even out.
Yes, and the evidently the landing pads, that's the end of the landing legs, had the ability to angle themselves for the greatest stability, and the legs adjusting the distance so the primary object would remain horizontal no matter what the terrain was. And
wow.
That is held up in a number of other cases.
Right. So Lonnie Zamora is still alive, isn't he?
Yes, he is.
And he has stuck to this story for all these years.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, he refuses to talk about it at all anymore because he was raked over the coals by the media. And I suppose some of the folks that talked to him. And we were in at the Aztec New Mexico conference a few weeks ago. And one of the speakers, Dwayne Tudall, who was a producer with the History Channel and a good friend of mine, and he had, we all went to Socorro. I just wanted to take the SIU team out, as they'd never been there, and show them the area. And Dwayne had been there, and he tried to call Lonnie and actually got him on the phone. He's actually listed, if you can imagine, in the phone book. And he said, you know, he's very cordial, but he just, he said, I just don't want to talk about it anymore.
Yeah, and, I can imagine after all these years, just ask again and again and again and again.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. Well, I was fortunate enough to talk to him on two occasions over the years, and he is indeed an extremely impressive witness. He really is.
So this was the case that, so I understand, turned Jalen Hynek around. Is that right?
Well, it started the turn, yeah.
Well, okay.
And by the time we met in 1968, he was turned.
He had already turned.
Yes, he had.
Right. Well, he was a skeptic. I've mentioned this on my show before, that Hynek was started out as a skeptic, but in the course of his duties with Project Whitewash, I like to call it, Project Blue Book, he was forced to look at the evidence. And once he did look at the evidence, he concluded, hey, there's something to this.
And, yeah, that's absolutely true. And
at least it wasn't closed-minded. You know, the closed-minded are not listening to this show right now. They hear UFOs, they turn the channel.
Well,
the
thing that I have to admit surprised me about Alan, after I really knew him on a very personal basis, was that he was extremely open-minded, and he didn't throw very much out. And he looked at this stuff from all kinds of angles. And it was at his suggestion in 1968 that I started specializing in these types of cases. Because we were, frankly, getting so many reports that you couldn't keep up with them. And as he pointed out in 68, you know, he said, the lights in the night sky don't give us much data.
Right.
And we need to concentrate on the cases that do. So that set me out on this path, and I recall very well the first MUFON conference, which was, I forget, 1969 or 70.
I
spoke, and I had 157 trace cases, and everyone was so impressed. You know, boy, that many. And now here we're looking at close to 4,000.
Oh, it's close to 4,000.
Yeah.
Then I misspoke at first. I thought it was over 4,000, more than 4,000.
Well, it at one time the catalog was, and I refined the catalog by taking out events where traces were found, but the object was not seen at the site generating those traces.
Okay.
They would be very similar. I keep those in a subcatalog because, who knows, we may get a case where exactly those types of traces are seen being generated by an object.
Right.
So now, actually, the refined total is 3,389.
Okay.
And but those are only cases where visually the object is seen creating.
Right. But the other cases have traces that are reminiscent of the other landing sites that have been seen. Is that correct?
Yes, they're close enough that they're interesting, but you can't say that they were caused by a UFO because a UFO wasn't seen.
You didn't see it. But what about the soil? What happens to this? Does anything happen to the soil that can't be explained scientifically with mainstream science?
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, another of the top 10 cases, I was fortunate to look into the Delphos, Kansas report back in 1971. And in that instance, it was a different type of object. It was about 8 to 10 feet in diameter and about 5 to 6 feet high and in thickness. And it hovered above the ground at a height of about 5 feet. And the witness was 45 feet from it and watched it for really an undetermined period of time. He estimated that he was out there for perhaps 3 or 4 minutes, but his parents watched a 30-minute show and half of another one. And so I've always had an idea that perhaps a little more went on than just the observation. And
so there seemed to be missing time there?
Well, there seemed to be. Mm-hmm. And I tried to get Leo Sprinkle. I tried to arrange for Leo Sprinkle to come down and talk with him and perhaps do some regressive hypnosis, which I'm not a huge fan of, but I trust Leo implicitly.
Mm-hmm.
And the parents wouldn't allow it. It was kind of witchcrafty stuff for them.
Yeah.
But at any rate, as this thing is stationary, 5 feet above the ground, and it's all awash with multicolored lights, changing constantly, very bright, and it's making a noise, he said, like an old out-of-balance washing machine.
Hmm.
And beneath it, he sees a sort of aqueous-appearing spray that's glowing and coming down towards the ground from the base of this thing. And the really incredibly odd thing is that this mist or spray ceased to be about a foot above the soil. And between the bottom of the spray and the soil, there was nothing.
Mm.
And yet, beneath the spray area, he could see forming in a circular pattern a haze, a mist, a fog coming from the ground up for maybe 2 or 3 inches. And so this thing hovers there for an undetermined period of time, and it brightens, the spray brightens, and the object tilts back vertically a bit and takes off down a 20-foot-wide shelter belt, makes a right turn and goes over a hog shed, and is flying to the south. As it passes over the hog shed, the sound changes, and Ron, the witness, loses his vision.
Mm.
Can't see a thing. And I made a point of saying, well, was it like, could you see spots? Like you see if somebody pops a flash in your face. And he said, no, just pure black.
Hmm.
But he could hear the sound of the object moving away, becoming a little fainter.
Hmm.
And he started regaining his vision, and he looked up to the south and could see it moving away. Ran to the house, got his parents, and they also saw the object in the south.
Hmm.
And it finally moved on, where it was seen by policemen in Minneapolis, Kansas, 10 miles south, flying over the town.
Mm.
And it was also seen by the farmer across the road who happened to be out on his tractor. He saw it come up out of the farm, and it touched down in his field and was kind of bouncing and grinding its way along the field. He said it looked like it was having trouble getting into the air, but it finally did.
Mm.
And so at any rate, as Ron's telling his parents about what he had observed, they're moving around behind the hog shed out into this very dark shelter belt area behind the hog shed, and the roof of the hog shed was glowing faintly. The back side of the hog shed was glowing faintly, and there was a faint glow down the shelter belt, and here is this brightly glowing 8-foot ring.
Mm.
And
if I could interrupt you right there, we're going to come back to this Delphos, Kansas case, but I'm going to have to take a break here to remind our listeners that you're listening to We Are Not Alone, and I'm David Twitchell. We're speaking with Ted Phillips, a UFO investigator, and you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves. And we're going to go back to Ted Phillips immediately after the non-commercial break, so please don't go away.
The United States Department of Education has a new program to bring some of the nation's outstanding public school teachers to Washington, D.C. Teachers will be there for a year and have a chance to learn about and shape national education policy. For information, visit www.ed.gov and click on Teaching Ambassador Fellowship or call 1-800-USA-LEARN.
Hungry?
The Skylight Cafe is convenient and offers a variety of food options to hungry students and staff.
Pizza, daily specials, sandwiches, and entrees.
How about ordering something hot off the grill?
Or if you just want a snack.
The Skylight Cafe has cookies, desserts, chips, fresh fruit, and a wide variety of beverages.
There's even a soup and salad bar. Ours are
Monday through Thursday, 7:30 a.m. to 7 p.m. and
Friday, 7:30 a.m. to 2 p.m.
The Skylight Cafe.
On Wednesdays, midnight to 2 a.m., listen to me, Underdark Eric, for The Underdark Show, where I'll be keeping you up with the best of indie rock, here on WHFR.FM, the only station making waves. Who really needs sleep anyways?
This is WHFR.FM, the station making waves. And I'm David Twitchell. You're listening to We Are Not Alone. We're speaking with Mr. Ted Phillips, UFO investigator of trace landing evidence cases. And Mr. Phillips, I'm sorry to have to interrupt you there, but we were talking about Delphos, Kansas. Now, the witnesses saw this craft. And hovering, we say, about 5 feet above the ground?
Yes.
And then took off over to Pig Shed, and is that it? The hog, yeah. Hog house or whatever it's called?
Well, fortunately, it didn't grab any pigs as it went over. That was a good thing.
No, that's right.
But anyway, make a very, very long story short, the ring, as I say, was glowing very brightly, and the soil in the center, in other words, they were looking at a donut. The soil in the center was not glowing. It was just black, muddy soil, and the soil around it was unaffected. And the parents squatted down by the ring, and they were curious. They were thinking it was probably warm, so not the best idea, but they both touched the soil. And in each case, their hands became very numb. And Mrs. Johnson wiped her hand on her slacks leg and trying to get the soil off. Her hands remained numb for about 2 weeks, and Mr. Johnson about 2 to 3 days. And I saw other people affected in the same way on touching the soil. I handled many pounds of it and never suffered that numbing effect. But
you've witnessed this before in the Delphos, Kansas case or in other cases?
In this case.
Okay.
Yeah, other witnesses that were there. And one of them was Dr. James Harder. He and I were out there about 8 months after the event. And we were taking some additional soil samples, and his hands became numb. And as it was in August, he started running for the farmhouse to wash it off. And he started sweating, and the sweat was getting in his eyes, and he unfortunately rubbed his face, and it became numb. And but anyway, back to the ring. Now, this is within 5 minutes of the ascent of the object. The Iran asked his mother, he said, "Do we have any film in the camera?" And so, boy, they all run to the house. They drag the old cheap Polaroid out of the closet. And the camera and the flash were two separate units. She just grabbed the camera, no flash. And that's very significant because when they went back out, she backed up, centered the ring in the camera, and took the only photo I've ever seen of a luminous landing site within 5 minutes of the object's ascent. And I asked her pointedly if, I said, could you see, was there enough light coming from this glow of the ring to be able to adjust the settings on the camera? And she said, Ted, you could have read a newspaper by that glow. And the photo is a great one. And it's this is a good time for a plug. Mm-hmm. You can see that photo on our website,
okay,
which is one word, ufophysical.com. And I have three photos of the ring on the site right now. And that photo and a photo taken the next morning by a sheriff and a couple of highway patrolmen showing the thing in daylight, and then another photo of the ring 3 years and 6 months later, and that is an incredible picture. If you want to see soil that has been changed pretty much forever, that photo shows it.
Okay.
And so anyway, the results of all this was the next morning when the sheriff and the highway patrolman arrived, they watched the dog, which was accompanying Ron while he was observing this thing. The dog run head-on into a wooden fence, head-on into a side of a barn, refusing to even be coaxed back into the ring area. And within 2 weeks, the dog, his head was swelling, and his eye was really looking bad. And they took him to the vet, and the vet extracted from his nose a thing about 10 inches long, which was covered with what looked like legs.
Legs?
Yeah, it was like the largest centipede you've ever seen in your life, except it didn't look exactly like a centipede. And the vet said, you know, I've never seen anything like this.
Huh.
And the dog lost his eye, but he did survive. And another interesting thing, you get a lot of animal reaction, especially from dogs. And this was a farm dog, had never been in the house in his life. And every evening following the event, at sundown, as it started getting dark, he would start tearing at the back door, screen door. And he actually tore up two screen doors before they put a metal one on. And he made so much noise, they finally started letting him sleep in the house. So he was, to say he was affected would be an understatement,
I guess.
And so at any rate, the sheriff arrives and he takes about a quart of the soil material and puts it in a an airtight jar, seals it. And we finally get the report almost 30 days after the fact. And unfortunately, we didn't have the internet back then. And when I arrived there, it was pretty remarkable because it had snowed the evening before, and it had started melting when I arrived there about 8 in the morning. And I walk out to this area, and there is a perfect ring of unmelted snow. While the snow is melted, and you've got a bog in the middle and around it. And so I took a number of photos, and then I squatted down and brushed the snow off the surface of the ring. And it was a very light brown and totally dry. And if you melted snow in your hand and let drops fall on this material, it would just bead up as though you were pouring it on a freshly waxed automobile. It would not absorb water at all. And in taking the samples, I found that this effect existed only in the ring material and down 14 inches into the soil, and ended
deep.
Abruptly at 14 inches.
That deep, huh?
Yes. And so anyway, we got
this crab,
a lot of this stuff to laboratories all over the place.
Huh.
And the best analysis really that we were getting back was from Oak Ridge, and the director of Project Orion there was a good friend of Alan's, and we were getting a pretty steady stream of letters from he and the project.
Mm-hmm.
And they started sending us some electron microscopic images, which showed that the soil was coated with some sort of material, which seals the soil. Consequently, it can't absorb water. And inside the coating, they sent us some images showing what they called icicle structures. And no one at Oak Ridge could identify those structures in that coating material. And so they were getting pretty excited with the analysis. And one day, Alan and I both get a letter from the director saying that due to a change in management, they could no longer work with the soil. Of course, they didn't return the samples. So that was the end of that.
I wonder who that new manager was.
Yeah, well, I don't know.
Did you ever find out?
No. But Alan was pretty upset. But we went through that with a dozen laboratories.
Well, you still had the ring. I mean, it's not like you lost all the samples because you go back to the source, couldn't you?
Well, the problem is, at this point in time, we've used all the samples up. I brought 38 pounds of ring soil and about 40 pounds of control soil out the first trip. So I could look through the numbers, but it was a lot of pounds of soil, and we've used it all up.
Oh, my goodness.
And the problem is that about 8 years after the event, they decided they were going to start putting cattle out in that shelter belt area, fenced it off. And any of the cows that would walk in that area would develop very bad disease of some sort of the legs, and they would have to be put down. And so they were pretty frightened by that, and they bulldozed tons of dirt over the ring. However, I did set some benchmarks when I was out there the first time. So it would be possible to go back with a good level and go right down to the soil. And I would love to do that at some point, because it's been pretty well sealed off, and I would love to see that ring now.
Yeah. So the ring actually doesn't exist today anymore, does it?
Not from the surface, no. But it's, I'm sure, still there. And
but there were no entities associated with this Delphos, Kansas sighting, were there? Just the craft.
You know, I can't really be sure, because I talked to Ron in 1998 was the last time I talked with him. And it was just he and I, and I asked him, I said, did anything else happen that you haven't told me? And he is very afraid for his kids. And there is something, and I'm not quite sure what, that he hasn't told anyone. And he really won't talk about it anymore.
It's kind of like Lonnie Zamora, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's kind of like a lot of UFO witnesses that, you know, they see something, they're amazed, and they want to tell people, and then the ridicule factor sets in, and they just clam right up. They don't want to talk about it anymore.
Exactly. And many witnesses now, I'm finding, unlike in the old days, they'll talk to you if you agree not to give out their names or location.
Right.
And of course, you know, I'm interested in the data, not spreading their names around. But
right.
Our cases at Marley Woods, which is an ongoing active site, I've been going there at the request of the witnesses since December of '98. And I have 197 witness names on file, and not one has ever gone public. And, of course, I wouldn't release them for anything.
Yeah. That's what these skeptics say. I call them cynics. I'm the skeptic. They're the cynics. They say, oh, these people just want their 15 minutes of fame.
Exactly.
When in 90% of the cases, maybe even more, I don't know in what you're used to, but in most, big majority of the cases, they say, you know, I'll tell you my story, but don't tell anybody it's me.
Yeah, exactly right. And 90% or maybe above is precisely right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's increased. It used to be that people were really not so reluctant to let you use their names.
Mm-hmm.
And really, I've never seen any point in using their names.
Mm-hmm.
If they say, yeah, that's fine, I don't care who laughs or whatever,
yeah.
That's a different thing. Of course, I would prefer to be able to use names. It just gives a little more credibility to the report. But if you know anything about UFO events and how witnesses are treated,
mm-hmm.
You could understand it. Mm-hmm. And
I've heard that before from the cynics, too. They won't give their name. Well, it's not very good, credible a case if they won't give their name. And so finally the witness breaks down and says, okay, my name is Joe Smith. And now we know that Joe Smith is insane or
That's
lying,
right.
you know?
That's
and,
right. Or just either the town drunk or a liar.
Right, right, right.
you know, the thing that really lends credibility for me and always has is, for example, in Marley, you have 197 witnesses. Not one has gone public. So why make up a big lie and not tell anyone?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no point in doing that.
This is true.
And these are people that could send a guy to the electric chair as a witness.
Right, right.
You know, and they see a UFO and suddenly they're not believable.
It's not within conventional wisdom.
Yeah.
We're going to get right back with Mr. Ted Phillips. But right now I want to take another non-commercial break and remind you that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the only station making waves. I'm David Twitchell. You're listening to We Are Not Alone. We'll be right back. Stick around.
I'm a doctor.
I'm a teacher.
I live in the South.
California is my home.
I speak fluent Spanish.
No hablo español.
I have brown eyes.
My eyes are blue.
We're very different people, but we do have something in common. I made a donation to the Red Cross.
When disaster struck and I needed help, her gift to the American Red Cross changed my life.
When you support the American Red Cross, you change a life, starting with your own.
Call 1-800-RED-CROSS or visit redcross.org and find out about life-changing opportunities in your area.
The performing arts are an important facet of life. There is no substitute for the relationship between audience and performer. Your contributions to the Henry Ford Community College Theater Program enable students and faculty to continue promoting HFCC's artistic standards. By becoming a member of the Friends of HFCC Theater, you are allowing the theater program to prosper through establishing a scholarship fund, improving costume and scene shop facilities, and enabling the continuation of musical theater productions. For more information on becoming a Friend of HFCC Theater, call
313-845-6478. Tune in to WHFR every Monday between 10 a.m. and noon to hear Some Velvet Morning, where I'll be bringing you the best in psychedelic folk, indie singer-songwriters, ambient electronic, and Third Eye opening instrumentals. I could sit here and name off subgenres all day, but you'd be better off just tuning in to hear me play the music. That's every Monday morning, between 10 a.m. and noon, here on WHFR.FM, the only station making waves.
This is WHFR.FM, the station making waves. I'm David Twitchell. You're listening to We Are Not Alone. And we're speaking with Mr. Ted Phillips, investigator, UFO investigator, trace landing evidence investigator, go on and on and on. He's been for years. Tell me, Mr. Phillips, After, since 1960s, when you began your investigations, the investigative tools have greatly advanced. Now, does this fact offer any more prosaic explanation to some of these cases?
Well, unfortunately, I have to be very honest and say that we really don't know a lot more. Well, we do know more, but we don't know a lot more as far as the origin of these things, why they're around, and really what they're up to. And one of the problems is that we always arrive after the fact. And we finally get the report, and we go in and we sort of pick up breadcrumbs after the thing is gone. And so I decided in January of last year that it's perhaps time for a different approach. And I put together a team that we call the Special Investigations Unit, SIU. And this is a team of experts, and we have three master divers. Some of these things, of course, are seen going in and out of water, and it's always nice to have that ability to investigate. And the primary purpose of this team is not to go in after the fact, but to insert the team into a known active area in order to get real-time imaging and data. And we're very fortunate because we have three such sites, the one that I mentioned at Marley and two other sites, and have already been able to observe and image some objects in just less than a year, really. And so we're very busy working on that project. And the idea, of course, is to get better equipment and be able to study the light spectrum from the things as they're seen, and to get better and better imaging.
Okay.
And from Marley, we have, several hours, really, of video that the local people, the owners of the properties, have taken over the last 9-10 years on their own. Unfortunately, they're using camcorders that are not built for that sort of imaging.
Right.
And I have a problem getting them to put them on tripods. So you get a lot of hand motion in the imaging, but nevertheless, yeah, it's extremely interesting stuff.
Yeah, there's a way to zero that in, the shake. You find a point on it. I'm not a photographic expert, but I mean, I know that you find a point on a certain frame, and each frame goes to that point, and it kind of, you know, steadies the whole picture. But but I know what you're saying. You need a certain kind of camera. But you have photos or on your website, or
yes,
videos. Do you have any videos on your website?
We do have some clips on the website, and what we're working toward is, of course, like just about everyone else, we're asking for donations to buy equipment, and what we're trying to do is to get a couple of high-quality CCD low-light imaging units to put up at Marley and have live streaming video to the website 24/7, so anybody can just go to the website and see things as they happen, and they happen quite often.
Wow.
And these are not just light specks off in the distance. And the as a matter of fact, the sightings over the last 9 years have ranged from it just about cover the spectrum of UFO sightings, except there have been no humanoid sightings, and only one abduction case that we're investigating, and it's several miles from the site. And but just about everything else has happened, from EM cases to landings to traces to the small light balls.
Once again, that website is ufophysical.com.
Yes.
That's ufophysical.com.
Yeah.
Now, in what percent, you mentioned humanoid sightings, in what percentage of the cases where there are trace landing evidence,
mm-hmm.
would you say that there have been entities witnessed?
Mm-hmm.
There were at... not Delphos, but they were at
Socorro.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah. Of the 3,389 cases, 19.7% involve humanoids.
19.7. You can narrow that right down. Huh?
Oh, yes.
You've got that data right in front of you, don't you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I run statistics constantly
all right.
and stuff. Yeah.
19.7.
Yeah.
So
which
actually,
is,
that's
an incredibly high number.
Yeah, really. I was going to say that is a very high number, given for the most part, you just see these craft, people just see these craft in the air. You know?
Well, that's the advantage to the landing cases.
Mm-hmm.
You see a very high percentage, number one, of multiple witness cases.
Mm-hmm.
You see a high percentage of daylight landings.
Mm-hmm.
And what you see is, in a high percentage of these reports, you have more than one witness in daylight standing within 100 feet and quite often within 50 feet of an object that's sitting on the ground.
Hmm.
And consequently, if little guys get out of it,
mm-hmm.
They get a pretty good look.
Mm-hmm.
And they get an extremely good look at the objects, and which makes these cases, in my mind, so incredibly important
mm-hmm.
for gathering data, because they're there at a distance under good seeing conditions
mm-hmm.
for a long enough period of time that those people are absolutely sure it's not the Goodyear blimp they're looking at, or Venus, or a satellite, or anything else that the government drums up,
right?
Or a stealth, you know.
I can just see James McGaha say, "Yeah, that thing on the ground, that was a planet Venus."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, it's unfortunately the one thing that we don't have in all these cases.
Mm-hmm.
I have only one well-documented case where the object that generated traces was actually photographed by multiple witnesses ascending from the ground 300 feet away in daylight.
Hmm.
And that's on the website also. It's the best, in my mind, photograph of a flying saucer I've ever seen.
Now you say photograph. Is this a video?
No. This was back in 1966. And,
oh, wow.
The guy grabbed two photos, and they've been thoroughly analyzed at Northwestern University.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing was so close that on the original 120 negative, it measured a quarter of an inch long.
Hmm.
And there is structural detail visible on it.
Mm-hmm. Now, this isn't... who was the witness? Did you know?
That is one of the cases where I can't reveal the witness.
Oh, okay. I can't worm that out of you, can I?
Well, that's, as a matter of fact, the case that got Alan Hynek and I together.
Oh, really?
It took me a long time to track this guy down, and he has a government position now and for sure wouldn't want to be identified.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, back then in the 60s, you know, they say, oh, these I can do that on my computer. I can do that with Paint Shop. I can do that, you know. Back in the 60s, they could not do that.
No, believe me, they couldn't.
And
no.
That's why Stanton Friedman always shows the older pictures,
mm-hmm.
Because you know, you can't say, oh, I can do that on my computer, because that could not have. And we know that particular picture, that image, has been around since 50s, 60s.
Mm-hmm. This was taken in November of 1966,
mm-hmm.
and Alan and I had our hands on the negatives and talked to the witnesses in 1968 after I finally tracked this guy down.
Mm-hmm.
So I know they are very much pre-Photoshop,
mm-hmm.
and
pre-Photoshop.
And, yeah, pre-Photoshop. But, yeah, and I agree with Stanton, who, by the way, constantly asked me, what's your numbers on the little guy cases? That's why I keep that stat in my mind all the time.
What's your number? Oh, the 19.7?
The 19.7, okay. Which changes, but...
Now, back in the 50s, it used to be a joke, little green men, little green men. Now, does anybody report little green men?
No.
Uh-huh.
No.
What are they?
No. They're almost always pale, ashen, kind of, I hate to say this word, gray.
Mm-hmm.
And
no, because that's what abductees / contactees / experiencers report seeing are gray beings.
Yeah, and you know, that started in 1955 with the Hopkinsville, Kentucky case.
Mm-hmm.
And those people, actually, I was a great pile of witnesses, a whole family, two families, and they didn't say little green men.
No.
And some news reporter decided, well, let's make this sound more sensational.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, it's a good case because I have photos taken by the sheriff where one of these little guys were supposedly shot by one of the witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
And they did kind of a backflip and ran off. They found a pool of luminous liquid.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, nobody bothered to take a sample. That's the thing that gets my blood pressure to a danger point is the number of these cases where samples were never taken.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've gone in behind Air Force investigators and then contacted them about, well, what did you do with the samples? Oh, well, I didn't take any. I assumed that the higher-ranking people would do that.
Air Force? Now, Air Force, according to the Air Force, doesn't investigate these things anymore.
Oh, no, not anymore. No. This was while Blue Book was still going. Oh,
okay.
I ran into that.
Okay.
And 1967. But
I'm being a little sarcastic here because... Yes, indeed, we have documentation to show that the military is very interested in these sightings and landing cases and even crop formations.
Yeah, they are indeed interested. And, of course, why would they dabble around too much in sightings made by the normal citizens when they can get the really good military cases?
Right,
they can keep them sealed up.
Right.
So
after all of these years of your investigations, what is your conclusions as to the source of these alleged landing sites?
Source is the tough part.
Mm-hmm.
What I like to say is that based on the facts, based on the things that I've seen, I don't mean I've seen a lot of flying saucers, but the traces and the data, I believe that what we call flying saucers are constructed devices, and they are under some kind of intelligent control.
Mm-hmm.
And at some points in the sighting, they are what we would call real physical nuts and bolts objects.
Mm-hmm.
And I can say that because I've taken a compression test on some of the landing indentations, which indicate that the objects tested weighed between 7 and 14 tons.
Hmm.
That's a real physical object.
Mm-hmm.
But I also believe at other points, for example, Valensole, France, the object flies away in daylight, disappears at just a short distance from the witness, instantly in daylight, and yet continues to affect the plants and soil underneath it for another 300 feet.
Wow.
So, you know, we're dealing with something we just really don't understand. But if we don't study it, we'll never understand it.
That's right, and that's why we do have to study it.
That's exactly right.
Once again, the your website is UFOphysical.com, and I really want to thank you for joining us. Run a little short on time, but thank you so much for joining us on We Are Not Alone. And I hope we can do this again sometime.
Sure, Dave. I very much appreciate the invite. I've enjoyed it.
I have too. And you have a email address in case somebody wants to write you? Is that on the website also?
It's on the website, yes.
It's on the website, mm-hmm. which is ufophysical.com.
Yes.
Once again, Mr. Ted Phillips, thank you so much for joining us, and I hope to do this again sometime.
All right. Thank you, Dave.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And if you have any questions or comments for me, you can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. Remember, there's only one T in Twitchell. And dtwitchell@hotmail.com. And please visit my website at ufoimplications.com. That's ufoimplications.com. And this show, as well as all the other forum shows, is now being archived at whfr.fm's website. And click on Archives of the Weekly WHFR Forum. And stay tuned to WHFR for the best in alternative music. And I want to thank you for joining us today. And please join us again the first Saturday of each month at 10 a.m. when we will again explore the mysteries of the UFO phenomenon. And until then, I'm David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.
You're listening to 89.3 WHFR Dearborn. We're bringing you non-commercial radio from Henry Ford Community College. Good morning, it's 11 o'clock and it's time for Light from the Underground. My name is Bill Keith. It's a pleasure to be here with you this morning and on into the early afternoon. We've got a lot of great music to squeeze in, and I thought I'd get started with one of my favorite new albums. This is from an artist named Jackie Green, and his new one's called Giving Up the Ghost, and every song I've been hearing off this, I've just been taken by.